I'm thankful to be back with you this morning. Debbie and I had a good week. She spent most of the week down in Birmingham with me. We had the opportunity to become acquainted with the members of the Pine Lane congregation down in the south part of Birmingham. And in fact, met some of your family while we were down there. And that was a good privilege, but it's always wonderful to come back and to be with familiar faces and people that we love so dearly. It is a true axiom that if something is repeated often enough, some people will believe it regardless of whether it's true or not. I'm hoping that this is a true axiom anyway. I believe it is. I keep telling Deb that I'm handsome. I think that if I just keep repeating that often enough, she will come to believe it whether it's true or not. But I suspect that you likewise believe that to be a true statement. And I'm going to give you an illustration of how it's happening in our country. And you could probably multiply this by thousands of times. Surely you've seen the same thing happen. I have heard the statement made a number of times that thousands of voters were disenfranchised in the state of Florida in the 2000 presidential election. Now, I've not seen any evidence to support that statement. There may be some, and I just missed it. That's entirely possible, but it seems to me that there was a good deal of investigation done into the election processes of Florida, more than we ever wanted to hear about. And I've not heard any evidence that this is the case. And yet, that same statement is repeated again and again by prominent national figures. And I hear people, just normal, everyday citizens like you and me, repeating the same statement. Well, you know, thousands of people were disenfranchised in Florida in the 2000 presidential election. It seems to me that what's happened is people have heard that statement enough times that they've swallowed the lie. And I believe that is a lie. Not just a false statement, but a lie. I believe it's being stated and repeated for a purpose. I think the motivation is clear. But they're repeating this statement even though they can't produce any evidence to support it. Well, that's just an illustration from our political scene or from our national scene. That same axiom is just as valid when you begin to talk about religious discussions or spiritual matters. If a particular doctrine is repeated often enough, there will be some people who will believe it, whether it's actually taught by the Scriptures or not. And in fact, you and I have to be careful that we don't fall into that trap. We don't need to be thinking about other people or other groups. It is possible that I can repeat something often enough without any kind of scriptural evidence or support, and you may believe it simply because you just keep hearing it. I believe sometimes we preachers do that. I think sometimes we offer a verse or a passage as support for a particular idea, but the verse doesn't actually teach that idea. I will confess to you that in the past, always in the past, that I've done that very thing. I've taken verses that I heard used to support a particular idea, and I've used them to support the same idea. And then at some point, I look carefully at that verse, and I'm thinking, that doesn't really say that. But I heard it, and then I repeated it, and maybe some others are repeating it too. Just because something's said often enough, or frequently, doesn't make it true. Hearers accept doctrine sometimes because it has a verse attached to it. Whether the verse really is relevant, or actually states the idea that's being purported or not. I believe that this same axiom is being illustrated in our society in the cultural and religious discussions regarding homosexuality. The homosexual community is working hard to get certain ideas ingrained in the mind of the public. I believe that they are falsehoods, and we're going to talk about some this morning, but if you just keep saying them long enough, the American public will believe them. Unless they are exposed clearly and frequently enough as falsehoods for what they really are. This morning I have two simple purposes, and I'll try to be brief about these things. I want to talk about five different falsehoods that are being circulated about homosexuality. And I guarantee that every one of you here this morning, unless you've been living in a cave someplace for most of your life, you have heard these statements. You've heard them on the news. You've probably heard them at work. Maybe somebody said these things to you. Or maybe you heard them at school. This is what your friends are saying when discussions come up about whether homosexuality is right or wrong or good or bad. And we're going to look at those five things. But the reason we're going to look at them is I want to impress upon each of us the importance of the truth being told about homosexuality. Friends, I think this country is in a battle. And the question of whether we will survive as a nation, as a society, and for that matter, the purity of the church may very well depend on how vocal we are about the truth. Well, first, let's talk about the lies, or at least the falsehoods. I originally entitled this Lies About Homosexuality, but a lie is something that is wrong or false that is told or given with the intent to deceive. And now we're beginning to talk about motivation, and I'm not even going to get into that. But I'm just going to say that some of these statements, well, the five that we're going to talk about, they're all false. The first one is the Bible doesn't really condemn homosexuality. It condemns promiscuity. And that's become a pretty popular statement because there are churches who are ordaining homosexuals as clergy persons. There are churches who open their doors and they are specifically geared to, quote, ministering toward the homosexual community. And they would argue that we are wrong when we say the Bible condemns homosexuality. What it condemns is promiscuous activity by homosexual persons. The homosexual who goes from partner to partner to partner without any kind of committed relationship, without love being involved, as they define love. Now, there is certainly much promiscuity in the homosexual community, but I want you to understand that statement is untrue. And I want to show you why it is untrue. The Bible condemns homosexuality, but it's not just promiscuity with reference to homosexuality. If you go into the Old Testament just to see what God's attitude was about that sin in the past, you'll notice a couple of passages, and there are others. I just put these up here for your consideration. A couple in Leviticus chapter 18, also in Leviticus 20, and both of them just condemn homosexuality outright. There's no statement at all about whether it is a promiscuous homosexuality or whether it's just a man lying with another man as he would lie with a woman. In other words, having sexual relations with another man. And so the prohibitions are just across the board. And the New Testament is not any different. I appreciate Noble reading the passage that I asked him to read in Romans chapter 1. There's a passage there, beginning in verse 24, that talks about the state of the Gentiles, the condition of Gentile society, at least from a moral aspect here, a sexual aspect, in these verses. And I want you to see how many times this sin is described and the way it's described. And I want you to note that there's nothing said here necessarily about promiscuity. It's just simply that homosexuality is condemned. It's described as uncleanness. It's described as lust, as vile passions, as unnatural or against nature. It's described as shameful. It's described as an error. It's described as the fruit of a debased mind. It's described as not fitting. Now, the homosexual community wants us to believe that the Bible never condemns homosexuality, and that's just not true. But the American public is starting to believe some of this because they've heard it again and again. You know, another argument that I sometimes hear is that in Genesis 19, Sodom was not destroyed for homosexuality, but it was destroyed for a lack of hospitality. God rained fire and brimstone down on the cities of the plain upon Sodom and Gomorrah because they weren't hospitable. Now, I'm not going to take the time this morning because I believe you can see the error of that statement just from Genesis 19. But I would encourage you to turn in your New Testaments to the very short book of Jude. In the book of Jude, in verse 7, Jude's talking about Old Testament examples of disobedience and punishment. And here's what he says about Sodom and Gomorrah. In verse 7, Jude 7, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example. Jude says these people gave themselves over to sexual immorality. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean homosexuality. There are other types of sexual immorality. And so Jude goes on and nails it a little tighter. He says they went after strange flesh. That's another way of saying they went against God's ordained order. It's like Nadab and Abihu offering strange fire or profane fire. Fire that God had not commanded. And that's what this text is talking about. I think you can see that from Genesis 19. But certainly, we would have to have help not to understand it from the 7th verse of Jude. Well, let me talk to you about another statement, another falsehood that's being repeated again and again, and that is that those who engage in homosexual practices have no choice. They were made that way by God. Years ago, saw a t-shirt in which someone said, the implication having to do with homosexual, God made me and God doesn't make junk. Implication then is that I'm not responsible for these choices because God made me that way. This is really an insidious one. It's not denying homosexuality. It's simply saying it's not my fault. It's God's fault if there's fault involved. But I'll tell you, it's interesting. There's no scientific proof that sexual behavior is genetically determined. Now, I want you to listen to me carefully, because we need to make a distinction here that's not always clearly made, and it creates confusion in the minds of some people, some Christians. The question of attributes or characteristics, not behavior, attributes or characteristics that are generally recognized as masculine or feminine, those things are genetically determined. There are some guys, the beard, the male beard. There are some guys, they shave before breakfast, and they have to shave after breakfast. I'm one of those guys that shaves every new moon. but there are guys, and you look at, and you wouldn't mistake them for a female for anything. They have all of the masculine traits in quadruplet. Okay? And then there are women who also tend to be more masculine, some of their traits, some of their appearance. There are men who tend to be less masculine in their appearance or in some of their traits. Those guys who shave once every fortnight or every new moon. And then there are guys, women, that appear more feminine as opposed to masculine. Those things are genetically determined. There's a whole spectrum of the masculine and feminine traits, and we don't all fall in the same place. All the men right here and all the women right there. But that's not the same thing as behavior. You don't control your genetic background. Yesterday, Katie and John came in and were visiting there at the house, and I was out working in the yard, and John came out and said, I got to show you something. Apparently, he and my two sisters and my wife and Katie were all in there, and they were looking at a dog book talking about checking, choosing the right kind of breed for your lifestyle, for your circumstances. And they looked up boxers because they love boxers. We had a boxer, that just a wonderful dog. But we noticed, what we didn't know, they're prone to tumors. Our dog died of cancer, a tumor in his chest. But they're also prone to hypothyroidism. And so the book said, be careful that you find reputable breeders or you end up with dogs that have these problems. There are serious problems in the breed in general. And John ran out there and said, we've discovered the truth about you. I'm hypothyroidism. I just discovered recently I've got a thyroid problem. And apparently it's because I didn't come from reputable breeders. That was his point. But I don't control that. I work with the equipment that was given me, and so do you. You didn't determine your eye color. You didn't determine your height. I would have opted for several more inches had the choice been given to me. You don't determine a lot of things that have to do with your physical characteristics, but that's a whole different ball game than talking about behavior. And homosexuality is, when we're talking about that, we're talking about sexual behavior. We're not talking about physical traits. And I think we need to be very clear about that. Let me make some observations about this very point. First of all, it would certainly be unjust for God to condemn people for behavior that they can't control. That's like spanking a baby who has no ability to understand rules or yes or no. We would look at parents like that and say, well, that's totally unfair. Well, it would be the same thing for God to punish people for behavior they can't control. Can I give you a footnote right here? And that is that there's a doctrine out there that says that God chose certain people to be saved before the foundation of the world, and by implication, He let the other ones be lost. And there isn't anything you can do about that if you're in the wrong camp. If you're one of the ones that God didn't choose for salvation, let me tell you, I can preach the gospel to you all the rest of your days. You can't respond to it. That's the doctrine. It's called Calvinism. And what it basically says is that God's going to condemn you for behavior that you can't really control. You don't have any option. You can't even really want to do good according to this doctrine. But that's the same thing that this homosexual community argument is making. That they're really not responsible for their own behavior. And it would be unjust for God to condemn people if they aren't responsible for their behavior. And yet, as we've already seen, and we could produce more scriptures if you'd like, homosexual behavior is clearly condemned in the scriptures. So either God is unjust, He's condemning behavior that people can't control, or homosexual behavior is a choice. You can decide what your behavior is going to be. Now, I believe God is just. I trust the scriptures in that. The scriptures affirm that God is just. So I conclude that homosexual behavior must be a choice. Now I want you to look at those observations and know for a fact that you do not have to worry about science vindicating this idea that somehow we are born as heterosexuals or homosexuals. It will not happen. If it does, then you take your Bible and you just chuck it. Because the principles of God's justice and His judgment don't apply anymore. They don't work. Well, another statement, we're on number three already. Another statement that keeps getting repeated constantly, and people are beginning to believe this, is that opposition to homosexuality is prejudicial behavior that is comparable to racial discrimination. If you don't agree with homosexuality, if you oppose homosexuality, you are somehow engaging in discrimination. This is really kind of a corollary to the previous falsehood. Now, and I'll tell you why. Because really, nobody chooses their race. Nobody chooses their nationality or their ethnicity. Nobody chooses their gender. And so for me to discriminate against you on the basis of gender is really irresponsible. Because you can't control that. It's an unfair basis upon which to make a discrimination or a distinction. And that's what discrimination is. I would certainly agree that it is unjust to discriminate against someone on the basis of gender or race or skin color. Those are all genetically determined. And once again, we didn't get to choose our breeders. But engaging in homosexual practices is not the equivalent of having a particular skin color or being of a particular race or coming from a particular ethnic background. Once again, homosexual practices are choices. But I want you to see that this is a very shrewd tactic by the homosexual community. Because in our country, there's hardly any worse sin than racism because of our history. And I'll agree, racism is a terrible thing. It's a dark chapter in the history of our country and many other countries for that matter. And so what you do, if you really want to get people to shut up about homosexuality, is you tie opposition to homosexuality to racism or discrimination in general, and all of a sudden opposition to homosexuality becomes a bad thing. That's the lie, that's the falsehood that's being told now. And it's being repeated again and again and again. The fact of the matter is, businesses and individuals, you and I, we constantly discriminate on the basis of behavior. Now, mind you, I don't think you ought to discriminate against people on unjust bases in matters that they really can't control. It's wrong for a woman to be paid less because she's a female if she's doing the same job as somebody else who's being paid more. That's just not right. But brethren, we do discriminate. We distinguish between individuals on the basis of behavior. You know what the interesting thing about this? You go into a business and apply for a job. And on the application there, put that one of your weaknesses is that you have a tendency to company theft. And see if you get hired. You ever do that when you go out to, you know, Wendy's or Home Depot or someplace, apply for a job? And on there, your job application's looking really good, but down at the bottom you put a little footnote and you say, listen, I'm still recovering from the cocaine habit, but I think I'm going to have it licked here in a couple weeks, and see if you get hired. Businesses don't hire thieves. They don't hire drug abusers. They don't hire child abusers. A lot of times, they don't even want to hire people who are convicted criminals, even if they've done their time and they've been released. And the reason is, that's the kind of behavior they don't want associated with their business, or they just can't run a business with that kind of behavior in their employees. Is that discrimination? You bet it is. They are distinguishing between good employees and bad employees. And if you do those things, you fell into the bad side. Do they have a right to do that? Well, they may not. Our government keeps on. People keep crying about this sort of thing. But I believe they do. And I'll tell you something else. We do the same thing. We discriminate between behaviors. Don't we? 2 successive summers, you've got a young man comes and cuts your lawn. The first year, it's a guy who just every week he's over there, he cuts the grass completely, trims everything. Mops everything up. You can tell how much yard work I do anymore. He rakes everything up, puts it away, packs it away, does a wonderful job. The next summer, you get somebody else. And he shows up about once every 3 weeks, and he kind of cuts in various patterns, doesn't get all the grass, doesn't trim anything. The third summer, who will you hire back if they both come and ask for a job? Well, you'll hire the second one because that's your nephew's cousin. No, you're going to hire the one that does the good job. You discriminate on the basis of behavior. And that's all in the world that people are doing oftentimes with homosexuality. They're saying that kind of behavior doesn't fit the circumstances that this person wants to be in. Like, for instance, teaching. Like, for instance, taking care of small children. Other jobs in which their behavior, their lifestyle is going to have an impact on the job that they do. Do we discriminate? Oh, yes, we discriminate. And I believe we should. I believe homosexuality should be opposed because of its consequences for individuals and for society in general. Well, number 4. Another statement that's being repeated all the time. And this is getting louder and louder. You've heard it, I'm sure. Those who condemn homosexuality are motivated by fear and or hate. Now, I will tell you, first of all, that's not a true statement. At least not as a general broad statement, But then I will tell you in the second place that I believe there are some people who are motivated by hate, and I don't believe that's correct. I don't know that that's true exclusively of homosexuality or opposition to homosexuality, but I believe there are people who hate homosexuals. And the news stories will tell you, will validate that particular point. But opposition to sin doesn't make me a hater necessarily. For instance, I'm opposed to stealing. Are you opposed to stealing? Well, certainly. Does that mean that you hate or that you fear all thieves? I'm opposed to the use of illicit drugs. Does that mean that I hate or that I fear all illicit drug users? My opposition is based on the moral teaching of the Bible. And my opposition is intended, and I believe yours should be also, to reclaim those who are involved in this sin or any sin, homosexuality is what we're talking about, while discouraging others from beginning that lifestyle. I make no apologies about the fact that I want our young people to understand this is wrong. You don't even need to think about getting involved in this, any more than you would think about this wonderful career stealing, robbing banks, or drug use. I want to discourage you from that. But I also think we need to be preaching to reclaim people who have been involved in that or are involved, that they might understand the liberty that's available in Christ Jesus. Now, Jesus opposed sin. Was he a hater? When you go to Matthew, the 23rd chapter, Jesus criticized very harshly the hypocritical Pharisees and scribes. Did he hate Pharisees? Who would say such a thing? But that's the argument, of course. It would apply. The Bible says in John 12 and verse 47, Jesus says that he didn't come to this world to condemn the world. He came to save the world. Now, the Hebrew writer says in chapter 9, the very end of that chapter, that he's coming again. The second time he'll come apart from sin. That is, he's not coming for redemptive purposes. He's coming for judgment purposes. But the first time he came to save people, not to condemn them. And that includes homosexuals, that includes thieves, illicit drug users, adulterers, all sinners. There's been an article that's been up on the Preacher's Corner. Many of you probably read it already, but I just want to read some things. I want you to understand how things are working on university campuses now, if you didn't understand this already. When you go to a state school, many of the state schools, here's the kind of stuff that your kids are going to end up facing. This is a story about the University of North Carolina. English professor there, her name was Elise Crystal, and they had a discussion about one author's views that, quote, society affords whites, males, and heterosexuals privileges that others, for example, blacks, women, and homosexuals, do not have. Isn't it interesting how the groupings are there? Skin color, gender, sexual practices. Two of those are genetic. The third one's a choice. But they group them together because they want you to think about homosexuality as though it was something that's genetically determined that you can't control. And it ought to be afforded the same kind of anti-discrimination protection that gender and race or nationality are afforded. Oh, that's shrewd. Well, in this discussion, there was a student by the name of Timothy Mertz. He made a comment in this class, in this discussion, that he was a Christian and that he felt disgusted, not threatened by homosexual behavior. He just said he thought threatened was the wrong word. He just opposed it. He was disgusted by it, but he didn't feel threatened by it. Well, the professor sent out an email to all of the students in that class naming this student. And what she did was she basically described him as discriminating against homosexuals. She says in this email, "I will not tolerate any racist, sexist, and or heterosexist comments in my class. What we heard Thursday at the end of class constitutes hate speech." He said, I'm disgusted by homosexuality. That's hate speech. And she groups that kind of speech in with people who would hate people of other races or hate people of other sexes, of the other sex. I lost my place here. She says, "What we heard Thursday at the end of class constitutes hate speech and is completely unacceptable. It has created a hostile environment I am deeply sorry and apologize to those of us who are now feeling that the classroom we share is an unsafe environment. He spoke up and said, I oppose that, and that made the environment unsafe. She goes on to say, for those of us who feel vulnerable or threatened, I will do my best to counter these feelings and protect that space from further violence. You speak up and say, I'm just disgusted by that practice. I don't agree with that. You are a violent person. You're engaging in hate speech. Well, this case, this incident, came to the attention of a North Carolina talk show, and the university officials found out about it, and the professor ended up apologizing. Well, the university, in their diligence, let me see if I can make sure I find it here. The department said no penalty or further action was necessary because Ms. Crystal had apologized for her actions, and the university had convened faculty workshops to discourage race and sex discrimination against white male Christian undergraduates. So apparently they thought she was discriminating against him because he was a white male. Violence. Hate speech. You oppose this and you hate people. You're a homophobe. You're afraid of your own sex. Well, I think that's all I'm going to talk about on this. We need to go on. But that's what's happening. That's the push. That if you oppose homosexuality, you're motivated by fear or hate. Well, here's the last one, number five. What two people do in the privacy of their home is of no consequence to society in general. Now that one sounds pretty good, but it's not true. Because what you do in the privacy of your home often does affect society in general. Let me tell you something about society. Society is comprised of individuals, and the behavior of individuals in essence affects the condition of society. Now, my particular behavior, my individual behavior, may not move society in some different direction, but we're not talking about one individual. We're talking about a community. We're talking about a practice that is widely practiced. Would we make this argument about divorce? Would we say that society is not affected by divorce because, after all, that's the business of two people, that's their own private matters? Who would say that children are not affected by divorce? Is there anyone here who believes that we're not seeing already in the public schools the effects of rampant divorce? Effects on our children. And if you don't think so, there are some teachers in this audience. You ask them. Find out what they think about it. Fact of the matter is, divorce is affecting our society. It's not a private matter, even though it's a relationship between two people. And homosexuality is likewise affecting our society. Let me tell you some things about homosexuality that you need to remember. First of all, it disregards God's plan for families. People want to make it sound like it's innocent, it's our own business, we're not hurting anybody. You are rejecting God's plan for the family. And I'll tell you, society's never helped, never advanced by people rejecting God's word. That's just the truth of the matter. Homosexuality says we don't need fathers and mothers. We can have two fathers, have two mothers. And homosexual couples are wanting to adopt children. What do you think they'll teach those children? Does it affect society? Oh, certainly it does. It's contrary to nature. You don't have to be a biologist to figure out that it will not permit procreation. I'm talking about homosexual practices. I'm not talking about some other kind of efforts to go around natural means. If God intends for this race to continue, for mankind to continue, then that behavior will eliminate the race. We'll do it in a single generation if all were given to that behavior. And importantly, it incurs the wrath of God. Romans 1:18 says the wrath of God is poured out against people who engage in this kind of behavior. And He destroyed the city of Sodom, the whole city, because of the behavior of those inhabitants. Brethren, I think we're fighting a war. And it's a battle of information. It is important that we point out the falsehoods that have been discussed in this study. You know, we sometimes concentrate on the legislative battles that are regarding moral issues that transpire. But may I tell you that by the time it gets to the point where Congress is discussing whether or not we should have a constitutional amendment that defines marriage as a man, as being between a man and a woman, we've basically already lost the battle. Because prior to that, the only way that that could even come to the Congress is when the American public has already begun to accept the falsehoods that we're talking about today. The battle is being won by the other side. They are talking, they're talking loud, they are talking everywhere. And Christians, we're huddled in our buildings, saying very little sometimes. That's not true of all, but saying very little. Note the changes in programming on television and tell me that you don't think the homosexual community is not winning the battle. Years ago, if Festus had been a homosexual, do you think he had ever been on Gunsmoke? Of course not. But now we have shows that are dedicated to that theme. Dedicated to the theme that what needs to happen is straight guys need to be converted to this unnatural lifestyle. We're losing the war. Years ago, homosexuality was hidden. People are ashamed of it, but not anymore. Now it is endorsed, it is open, it's out of the closet. And the reason is they're winning the battle of information. And I'll tell you why that's important. Because if you want to change people's attitudes towards sin, you can do it in just two or three steps. Let me suggest three to you. First of all, get rid of the shame at the committing of the sin. If you can take a shameful act and somehow convince people that it's really not shameful, then you've moved them well on to the way on to the next step, and that's to get people just to accept the sin. Not necessarily involve themselves, just accept it. There was a time when people would have come unglued if in public media we'd had shows that glorified homosexuality. But now, people may not choose to watch that, but they say, oh yeah, I've seen that. That's over everywhere. We're just resigned to its presence. That's already step number two. And step number three is that people need to embrace the sin. You need to get out and support the right of homosexual people to marry and to enjoy the same civil and legal rights that men and women do when they marry. Where are we in this path to the changing of the attitudes of America towards homosexuality? We're way down the path already. Well, what can you do? Anybody here got a national talk radio program that you could, you know, just get on there and beat on this subject? Anybody here own a newspaper? You can just print all the articles that you want. Can I give you an illustration? And I'm going to embarrass Barry Britnell. Barry sent me an article that he had written concerning the upcoming election. It's not just a political piece. It is a question of morality. And he sent this article to me. It wasn't done through the normal, the membership thing. That he did it separately to me and apparently a number of other people. That article on his web page. He's put together a web page. And on that web page, which can be reached anywhere in the world by millions of people, he's speaking out about moral issues. I don't know anybody here who owns a radio station or a newspaper. And I'll tell you what, if you've got a computer, you can speak out. You can do what he's done. You can do what other people are doing when they write articles to newspapers or they make use of avenues that they have to speak out. The American public is constantly being subjected to falsehoods regarding homosexuality. Are they hearing the truth? Who do you think will tell them the truth? It'll be us. Our young people are on the front lines. Like it or not, you people are the ones that are going to do battle with the most effectiveness. You have access to other young people in their formative years. You need to be telling the truth to a generation who's hearing falsehoods from all sorts of sources, many of whom they respect. I will tell you, I've been renewed recently in my determination to speak up. Speak up, speak louder, speak more often. We will not win this battle unless we get the truth out and confront the falsehoods. We just looked at five. We could look at many others. But I hope that you likewise are motivated to do the same thing. Don't feel like you're just one person, you can't do anything. You'd be surprised what one person can do. You just work in your corner of the world. And I'll work in mine, and others will work in theirs. And we can change this nation. Now, I don't want to leave the wrong impression with anybody here this morning, that the impression that homosexuality is this terrible sin. It's much worse than all other sins. Because the fact of the matter is, when you go back to that passage that was read earlier on in Romans 1:18, it says the wrath of God is poured out against all unrighteousness. And no thief ought to be patting himself on the back and saying, well, at least I'm not a homosexual. No drug user ought to be thinking, well, at least I'm not as bad off as that fella or that woman because they're homosexuals. The fact of the matter is, all sin will condemn if it's not repented of and rejected. The gospel says that people who are homosexuals can be washed, justified, sanctified. That's Paul's language in 1 Corinthians 6. Verse 11. And this morning, regardless of what sin you've committed, you're not a Christian. The blood of Jesus Christ, as Gary indicated a little bit earlier, and took the Lord's Supper, it'll wash you clean. It'll justify you. It'll reconcile you to God. And there isn't any sin. Not homosexuality. Not adultery. Not gossip. Not murder. Not any sin that God will not forgive if people will come in penitent faith, believing Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, with all their hearts, and determined to turn from sin. When those people are immersed, buried with Christ in baptism, the blood of Jesus Christ rolls over them and washes them clean. And they're free. Free from all the guilt of the past. And they walk with Jesus from that point on. You need to do that this morning. We encourage you, come to the front. We'll assist you even as we stand and sing this morning.